The Guardian.
Hello, my name is Andrew Pulver, and I'm the editor of The Guardian's film website. In May 2011, Fidel Sassoon visited London in connection with the release of a documentary film about him, and I went to meet and interview him in a hotel in London. It was a fascinating conversation. Sassoon was one of my personal heroes, not so much for his hairdressing, but for his activism in the just after the war as a fighter against the fascists in the streets of London. And he obviously had a fantastic career as a hairdresser and a designer. Because the film was about his life, he ranged widely over his childhood and his formative influences and his career. We didn't use the interview at the time because the recording was in a very, very noisy cafe, as you'll hear. But once we received the news of his passing, we thought it would be interesting for people to hear it again. I started off talking to him about his early childhood in London's East End.
So can I ask you just to talk a little bit about your very early life? I mean, for me, that's, you know, so not being that big an hairdresser, that was always the aspect of your life that I was always really interested in. Particularly, I suppose, your very early life between Shepherd's Bush and Whitechapel, sort of strange duality, if you like. I mean, how did you end up in Shepherd's Bush and your family end up there? But how did the family end up there? Did they just move there?
No, there was Sephardic Jewish, and there was a big Sephardic Jewish community in, you know, Shepherd's Bush.
Oh, right.
Quite a big one.
I didn't know that, right, yeah.
And that's right. The reason I was born, I guess. My father was born in Salonika.
Oh, right, yeah.
My mother was born in England.
Right, right. And so, but then, obviously, circumstance forced a move to the East End.
My father left the family when I was 3 and my brother was 6.
Yeah.
6 months old.
Yeah.
And she was impoverished and about to be removed from the sort of flat we were living in. And she couldn't take that, so in the middle of the night, an uncle took us to the East End, where my Aunt Katie lived, right in the lane, Petticoat Lane,
right.
Wentworth Street.
Right, yeah.
Terrible flats. There were tenements.
Yeah.
All they had was one area where you could use a tap, which was cold water.
Yeah.
You know. And that was in the kitchen.
Is it still there, the place, or is it?
Oh, no, they took it down about 10 years ago. I think everybody was ashamed of it. But we, you know, living amongst the Barrow boys and the excitement of Petticoat Lane wasn't bad for even for a 3-year-old. Right? Of course, my brother was much younger. And when I was 5, my brother said to my mother, could we go downstairs and ask Mrs. Cohen for some bagels? It was bagels in those days.
Absolutely. Who
bagels.
Says bagels?
Yeah.
Americans,
yeah.
Yeah.
See, I told you it was bagels.
Yeah.
In those days, yeah. So she'd have yesterday's bagels. Oh, here come the schnorrers. And she'd give us a couple of bagels each and Thomas is going. And one day, during this exercise, my brother was missing. I couldn't find him anywhere. So I went upstairs and said, Mother, Ivor, that was his name, Ivor, just vanished. I don't know where he is. So my mother, who was rather smart, got as many people as she could to start looking for my brother. And I swear, it must have been 3 hours later, we found him in a banana box asleep with the happiest look on his face. In a banana box. And of course I thought that was obviously my fault, you know, I should have been looking after him better. And My mother then decided, because my Aunt Kate had three children, a son and two daughters, and five of us were sleeping in one room on mattresses, while my Aunt Kate and my mother had the other room. And that was all there was to it. It was a kitchen, if you could call it that. But there were tenements.
Yeah.
Dreadful places. I'm sure when they were put up, the people that were living in caves thought, well, this is a marvellous change.
Well, I think it's the model dwelling idea, isn't it? I suppose it's the model dwelling, isn't it? That before the sort of slums they would have come from would have been really, really unpleasant. So can I ask you a bit about what happened to you later when you were a teenager, early 20s?
Because
I sort of read all the 43 group books ages ago. And I was sort of interested to hear from the horse's mouth, really.
I'll give you the whole story.
Yeah, absolutely.
My mother decided she'd go to the Jewish authorities and ask if we could be put in the orphanage.
Right, yeah.
So I went there first. I was there 7 years. My brother was too young. He came a year and a half later.
Right.
Then the evacuation when the war started, and we came back. Came back in 41, 42. And I got a job as a messenger boy, riding a bike from the city to the docks.
Yeah.
And every morning. And the Luftwaffe had rearranged the whole architecture of London. And the streets were down, and there was a few bodies and blood and what have you, and people were clearing up as best they could. So we had to find different routes to the docks where we were taking these messages. And my mother found out after 3 months and said, I've had a premonition, you're going to be a hairdresser. And she put me at Adolf Cohen, and that was 101 Whitechapel Road, Adolf Cohen. Hairdresser and wig maker.
Is he still there? I can't believe that.
He'd be about 140, I think, if he was still there. But no, he's not there. I've driven around there many times since. But it was right next door to the commercial gas company.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It wasn't next door Cartier.
No. Plus, with all the bombs falling, that can't
it was
with all the bombs. Yeah. With all the bombs falling, that can't have been.
Well, yeah, you know, the other side of the street was completely bombed out. Yeah.
Right.
So the tailors use it as a union place.
Right.
And cars would come in the morning, and if they needed two workers, they'd take two or three or whatever. It was a place where they were waiting for work.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, enough about those days. Then the war was over, and Mosley came out of jail. He'd been house arrest. But the fascists mainly came out of jail, you know, the thugs.
Yeah.
And they started all over again.
What sort of year was this? Was this like straight after the war, or was it?
This was straight after the war.
So it's sort of 46, 47.
46, yeah. Absolutely right.
Yeah.
46, 47. So the guys coming home, there was a guy called Jerry Flamberg, changed his name to Lambert.
Right.
Had to. But he was Jerry Flamberg, and tough as teak, 250 pounds of solid muscle, won the military medal at Arnhem, which is one of the toughest battles of the war, for saving, he was a sergeant, saving quite a few of his men, and a great sense of humour. And so 43 ex-servicemen had a meeting, and they decided they were going to stop Mosley one way or the other. So they asked for volunteers. Well, there must have been 500 or 600 volunteers. And my mother was a very strong Zionist. We knew exactly what had gone on in Poland with the German concentration camps. And when I told her I was joining the group, she said, "Good son, good." So I was in the 43rd group. There was some tussles, a couple that were interesting. There was once I walked into the salon with a big bruise. The guy had a big ring on who hit me. I'm glad he didn't have a knuckle duster. I would have been in real trouble. And the client said, "Good God, Vidal, you look awful. What happened?" I said, "Oh, nothing, I just tripped over a hairpin," because we weren't allowed to tell anybody what we were doing, you know.
How old were you at the time?
70.
Right.
18, I was called up. They were still calling people up
service. My dad did national service in 1950, I think.
So. There you go. Yeah. And look, we had nothing to do. But they put us in different trades or what have you.
Right.
I came back from... They gave us a weekend's leave. Came back on the Monday morning, as I was supposed to, and we were all lining up on the square, you know. Excuse my back.
Absolutely fine.
You okay? And the kid next to me, out of nowhere, I didn't even know him, said, "Who are you pushing, you dirty Jew bastard?" You know. "Well, I just been listening on Yom Kippur to a speaker who was talking about the Holocaust and the horrors of Europe. I just went nuts. I first of all knocked him to the ground, then got on top of him, banged his head. Then they..." There must have been about six people pulling us apart. We went in front of the officer, just charming young English man, you know, and he listened to the stories, and he gave this guy a real telling off. I mean, you know, what do you think we've been fighting all these wars for? You know, 55 million people killed. And if I see or hear that you've opened your mouth once more, you'll be in real trouble. And he let him go. Then he said to me, "I'm terribly sorry that happened. It was uncalled for, and I'm terribly sorry." This is a young English officer. And fortunately, we all don't think that way. And, he said, obviously for fighting on the parade ground, it could be a serious charge. But he said, "Try and keep out of trouble so soon." You're dismissed.
Great line.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
Well, a young lieutenant, you know. Yeah. And then Israel came along.
Yeah. What actually motivated you to come back? You may have said something about it in the film, but... obviously, you went to Israel.
Yeah.
But returned to England.
Well, I was in Israel a year, and it was the year there was loads of action.
So it's 48.
Yeah. And I was in the Palmach, which was kind of a commando group. We prided ourselves with being the best.
Best
the training was murder. Yeah. I've never been so fit. Training was unreal, and mostly the kids were from Hakshara Hulata, which was Lake Hula. They were mainly kibbutzniks born in England, born in Israel, from Hakshara Hulata, which was on Lake Hula, the fishing kibbutz.
Right.
Eventually they drained and used and did and created agriculture there. Anyway, I spent a good time with them until the war was over in about November.
Right.
Something like that. I'm trying to think the exact date that it finished.
I can look that up.
November, December, yeah. And we lost quite a few very good guys. There were, actually, they used to call us Anglos. There was Colin Fisher, myself from here, Jack Aptaber from Australia, and a guy called Shimmy Goldberg, who was from Altoona, Pennsylvania. And the four of us were accepted in the Palmach.
Yeah,
and Jack was shot in the shoulder and arm during the battle. He was taken off. And Colin, a shell exploded, and he had problems walking after that, but he was in hospital for a little while. I was fine. Nothing happened to me. Nothing happened to Shimmy. But I got a telegram after 1 year in Israel because I was deciding whether to stay or not. You know, I was very tempted. Very tempted. And it was for my mom. And it said, "Stepdad's had a heart attack. Come home and earn a living." There's no money coming into the house. So I had to, you know, I had to go back into hairdressing. So I think there's more than hairdressing to be excited about.
Yes.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, I look back and think, didn't do too bad with your adventures, kid.
Absolutely. I'll ask you some very brief questions about, because obviously all the hairdressing stuff, I think, is very well known. But from my point of view, I mean, obviously, because I'm interested in cinema, I was sort of interested to find out about the cinema connections of your work. And it just seemed to me that obviously they make a big thing in the film, but presumably it was true for you as well, that the Rosemary's Babies mention. Did a sort of great thing for you in 68. Was that the case? Or?
I think it was earlier in the 60s, but check it out.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty sure it was Rosemary. I mean,
yeah, Polanski invited me over to cut Mia's hair.
Yeah.
And she'd been chopping it herself. I don't know why, but she'd been chopping it herself. She was married to Sinatra at the time. And she came in and said, "Can you do anything with this?" So I said, "Yeah, take it really short, because it's the only thing I can really do and make it look good." So she had a perfect shaped head, really beautiful bones, perfect shaped head. So you could do anything you wanted to really on her, and I just cut it very short. And he calls me about a month later, Polanski, and said, "Can you come to Hollywood and cut Mia's hair for a movie?" I said, "I cut it about 6 weeks ago, a month ago." He said, "Well, it grows, doesn't it? Take a half an inch off." Well, it grew enough to cut it again by the time I got there. And that's how my American experience started, really.
I mean, what effect did the mention in the film have on your sort of business, if you like? Must have been pretty big.
It was... the reason it was big... first of all, she was Mrs. Sinatra and Mia Farrow. To the cut, there must have been 100 newsmen. Some NBC, CBS, you know, ABC... plus photographers, plus magazine, all kinds of things, taking pictures. So what it did for me was quite extraordinary. We were known on the fringes. I mean, we were known in fashion circles, obviously, because we were working with all the fashion people in London, Paris, New York, and Milan. We were, you know, we'd doing shows and what have you. But the interior didn't know me at all, you know. And by the time the Mia thing got around, including film of the haircut, they do a middle America knew me.
You know the bit where she says, "I've been to Vidal Sassoon," yes, on the film? I mean, was that written in?
I didn't know.
Did you not know that was
going to happen? I hadn't a clue it was going to go in, yeah. Yeah. And, of course, he hated it.
Just tracking back a bit, I remember being very interested in the film by the fact that you seem to work very, very closely with photographers, because we were talking about being part of the fashion world, where when you cut the hair of the actress's name, I can't remember, who was the...
Nancy Kwan.
Yeah, Nancy Kwan, where you could sort of phone up Terence Donovan and kind of get him to come around.
Yeah.
I mean, how closely
did...
No,
I went to the studio.
Oh, went to, I mean, how sort of closely did you work with them?
Well, they were my friends. I worked every week with a photographer somewhere. You know, whether it was Bailey, Avedon in New York... Who's the other wonderful photographer in New York?
Not Irving Penn.
Pardon?
Irving Penn?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Is that the one? Yeah.
Thank you. It was Irving Penn. And what a charmer.
Right.
Funny enough, the difference between the studios, Avedon had music swinging like crazy, the girls bouncing in front of mirrors, the whole bit going on. Penn. He took beautiful pictures in a very quiet way. And both were a joy to work with, and different techniques. Yeah.
But the images that they created, were they things that you sort of realised the value of? Because they seemed to me to be very powerful. In particular, the sort of Nancy Kwan picture was really amazing. I mean, that must have helped your work a lot.
Enormously.
Yeah,
yeah. Nancy Kwan... probably became the cut that's been utilized in many countries. A bob, short back, longer sides.
Yeah.
If they can cut it.
Yeah.
Get it, you know, good hairdresser can really cut. Do a wonderful job, make that hair swing like crazy. Shake it and swing with it. It was... so many good ones around these days in so many countries. I give it friends in Tokyo who've got the cut off perfectly. China now, we've had to open our second academy.
Well,
the
recently,
first one was too small.
Yeah, recently.
Recently, 6 months ago. Because the first one was really not big enough.
I mean, these academies are actually, you know, arguably one of your sort of big... kind of legacies, are you sort of...
There was an argument about that at first,
yeah.
And I said, look, there is no argument. If you keep everything secret, it dies with you. But if you create something that can become international, it's there long after you're gone.
Yeah.
And I said, and that's the way I want it.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.